There's something wrong somewhere. This is Channel 1 over. This is Channel 1 over. And it seems to have something on it. This is Channel 1 over. This is Channel 1 over. And something is on it. This is Channel 1 over. I haven't skipped it. And something is on it. This is Channel 1 over. And something is on it. I haven't skipped it.
The mother said, fishy on that. They couldn't stand that, Lisa. But he said, well, I tell you what, I'll be gone about a week. Why don't you take the horse? And then when I get back, I'll bring you the other horse and we can swap back. The child has something to ride. So under those conditions, she took the horse. 2 days later, she called and she asked, said the little girl was interested in the horse. How much was it? He told her. She said, oh, we couldn't go that for an Appaloosa. She said, well, I didn't expect you to buy the horse. I'm going to bring you one. Well, anyway, before he took off, a Virginia woman called and said, don't get us a horse. This is the horse. It's a good case. Barbara could do it better. She heard most of it. But this is where you like to hear him talk.
He said something for the second time today that got me completely thrown. Yesterday, or the first day, the time I talked to him, he said something about, you just think about how much you want. Today he said, now look, you ride the way I like. I love what my young horse is ridden. And he said, when you come back down on vacation, come on over, and we'll work with some horses and see. And you decide how much you want to ask. Salary. That threw me again, because I haven't the vaguest idea. I couldn't name a salary, you know. I don't have any idea.
Oh, I think you could work that out all right.
Yeah. And all he'd have to do would be name a salary, and I'd accept it.
Quarter.
Quarter a day or something.
Gas money. Well, I like the way he talks. You know, he moves, he's business, but all the time he's watching you, there's nothing to be uneasy about. He knew what sort of horse you were riding. He knew that you were stubborn. He wasn't looking at that.
Oh, he'd already seen. I mean, all he had to do was look at that.
Did you ride Missy?
Square nose.
No,
I didn't even get on Missy.
She was on Pussy.
I was on Pussy, and I knew she wasn't going to canter. She was doing her leads fairly well out here, but by the time he came, she was lazy.
Well, that's why I told you he was, you know, coming. And I thought maybe you wanted to switch, you could, but it's just as good. You know, she could tell you could ride.
That's all.
If he had had any doubts, he would have stayed to see some other riding and lunging.
Mm-hmm. No, I think another thing was, yeah, what I did with it was just exactly what I do with a young horse. I thought, well, that was intentional. Nothing.
He even liked the inside rein, inside lead. That made sense to him. Everything he said was just what he liked.
Mm-hmm.
Nice to talk to somebody who knows what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah. Knows more about it than I know.
Well, you don't have to strain. Yes, but. How long you been?
It was today, Monday, until about 4:40.
That'd be fine. I need
4:40 to ride.
I just thought of something.
What's that?
I thought I was a lot more obvious than that when I was trying to get Pussy into a lead. Could have sworn I was.
There was no motion at all. He was real pleased with that. He couldn't tell what you were doing. Quiet.
I could have sworn I was being as obvious as I could be.
If I was quite proud of what you were doing, because I know Pussy. I had sort of wished you were on Missy, but
you would show off your horse. Well, see, I thought
as well.
If you had a little more time, I was gonna throw on the lunge, but it was obvious, you know. He really did need to go on them.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and I thought it was real nice of him to come over, so I wouldn't have
keep him. The fact that that he came.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was that business.
Well, I don't know. I'll take you.
Now, this is Channel 1 over and the end of something. This is the end of something. This is Channel 1 over and the end of something. Now, this is much later. This is January. This is Sunday, the 4th of January, 1970. Faye and Mamu and I were finished supper, and Faye had written up, some time ago, this little account of Barbara's departure. She managed her own departure, and she'd be smarting from it for the rest of her life. And Faye handed me her page on it, and she was just talking at large about it. I thought we'd better get it at large on the tape. It's just a remarkable thing, just a remarkable picture. Now, this is Channel 1 over around 120, 25. And this is the Sunday, the 4th of January, 1970. Now, where was that Faye, that picture of Barbara, when you saw her with that hard riding hat on? Where was she then?
Barbara was standing in line at the Eastern Airlines with a bunch of student stand-ins. And I looked up, and she had this hard riding cap on. The back of her head wasn't on right.
Red.
It was black. And she hadn't had a haircut since she'd been here. She looked like a waif. And she had this paper sack in her hand. It was just filled up to the top. And she had to hold it at a funny angle because I had given her a little box of camellias. And written, and she had promptly turned it upside down, so I had written on one on top, big words, big letters, top. So she had to, while she was standing there with me, at least she had to hold it so she, the top would be on top. I think she just as soon I'd left that box off. But she was trying to hold on to that, and she had her bag over her shoulder. And I had given her a candy bar because she wasn't going to have any lunch. And that candy bar was sticking out of one side of her pocketbook. And up against the wall, close to her, and every once in a while she'd eye that wall, was this queer-looking soup box that she had taped up and had put a rope around and tried to tie it up with these strings. She had three different combinations. And it was wobbly looking anyway.
Now, that's not the one that came back.
Yeah.
And it was leaning against the wall?
It was leaning against the wall there at the airport. And as she got closer up in line, she went over and got it and leaned it against her leg. And there she stood. And she had two beautiful matched pieces of luggage there, too, that she sort of scooted on up in front of her. But this box and this sack. And when she got to be weighed in, he put a tag on it. And since the box came back, now I know what the tag said. He wrote, somewhere along the line, they wrote, "Hold at Jefferson for pickup." And I was surprised that he put a tag of anything on it, because it just didn't look like he could lift it. When the clerk lifted it, it sort of pushed out at the side. She had heavy books in it.
Oh, she put books in that
bulgy
thing.
She put books in that little flimsy suit box. I don't know how many. We'll have to see. And she had her heavy clothes in it. She had her heavy jeans, those the things she'd been wearing out here, her rough clothes. And I think she wrapped up a few books and they put it in there. And it was heavy.
What about that English riding suit, pants suit, what do you call it?
Oh, she had, you know, she had one of the only things she bought in the way of clothes in England was a pants suit, skirt, and a pair of pants, and a coat. And she had this on.
She wore that.
She wore that, yeah. With the pants. And with that, you see, that hat, that cap, wasn't on properly. There wasn't any other place for her to put it. She tried to put it in the paper sack. And she worked at it. She was over there trying to put that hat, and I just shook. She tried to put it one way, and she tried to put it another, so she just quit trying to get it in and stuck it on the side of the back of her head. But when she finally got herself cleared out, and with that candy bar in her, she took it out of her bag and had it in her fist, and when she still had the paper sack, she went on board with that paper sack and the box of camellias, and that hat still on the back of her head, and she
had a shopping bag.
Shopping bag, yeah. And with that toss, she tossed her head, just as if this is the way I wanted it to be. And, you know, that old Ishmael in her.
Yeah.
And then before she left, she said she hated for people to know when she was leaving or when she was going to arrive.
Oh.
I said, Barbara, I always thought I had felt that way too. She says, you know, if I just got 10 minutes in Jack's to get from one plane to the other. And she said, I could get left. And she said, you know, I wouldn't care. I just wouldn't care. But she said, if somebody on the other end of the line knows I'm coming, it makes a difference. And I thought, well, you know, this does. It's just not much fun to travel when you've got to be there on time. And she was feeling a little pinched. Because, you see, when she made the reservation, she knew I taught.
Well, now, wait a minute, Faye.
Yeah.
What was that about making the reservation through World Service?
Oh, well, you know, she told me she liked to make her own plans. I suggested that she just call World Service and let them make the reservation.
Now, that was right down the street. She could walk.
She could have walked to pick the tickets up there.
Mm-hmm. Made the reservation, got the information, and picked up the tickets all at one time.
Right, and wouldn't have had any problem at all. But she preferred to go through Eastern.
That's her words.
She said she had experience and she preferred to go through the airline itself. And I just said, well, you know, you have to go all the way to the airport. Well, she said, you know, they could mail it to me. But of course she didn't make the reservation in time for them to even get it in the mail to her had she wanted it. So she slipped out there one morning and picked them up.
When nobody was looking.
When she didn't know I knew it. She didn't mention it. And what?
You just infer that she did.
Yes, because she had the ticket.
Because she had the ticket.
And because she took a trip. And what's more, you see, she didn't have her schedule. They gave it to her over the telephone. And that long telephone conversation she had from the ranch, she didn't remember to make the reservation in town. And she wrote it down on a letter that she had, that you had Xeroxed. And it was stapled to that letter. And when she got ready to get, when she got in town, she said, I don't know my schedule. I did say, World Service would have made it out for you. She said, well, she made it out, but she had packed it. And it was in that suit box. So she didn't know she knew she was leaving Gainesville at noon, but she didn't have her schedule from there on out.
Mm-hmm.
She vaguely remembered that she had 10 minutes in Jack's.
Yeah. When did all that material get packed, Faye? I wasn't conscious of it.
Well, you know, she said 2 or 3 times. See? I'm not sure. She said 2 or 3 times, I'm not sure just how to get all this stuff in, what I ought to put it in. But she said, just watch me pack. I can get more things in a bag than anybody you ever saw.
Oh, she said that.
She said that. And then she announced that she had a whole bag full left over. And she never comes out and asks for anything. She sort of said, is there a suitcase, a suit box? Do you suppose I could get a suit box? And I found one. Or I told her where there was one, and she went and looked and found one. And she put the stuff in that suit box. I think it was the one they had sent the stuff in to her. And she packed her heavy clothes, jeans and things like that, she said, and a few books. But it wasn't tied up or taped or anything when she took it, put it in the car to take it to town.
Oh, it wasn't?
No. She just took the ropes with her. She was going to do that while I talked.
Well, that was on Tuesday morning when she was leaving.
Yes, Tuesday morning when she was leaving. And said, I was teaching. And I heard her in there going back and forth, getting scissors, and she came to the door 2 or 3 times, and finally she said she couldn't tie the rope. And I said I'd help her. And between students, I went back there, and I said, why not tape it? So she went down and got some tape. And she couldn't make the tape stick.
Why, Faye? That was within an hour of train time.
Oh, yes. Yeah. She couldn't make the tape stick. So she came back and she said, I don't think this tape's going to work. I said, well, get some books and put on top of it and hold it down. And she finally came out. And I had a lesson up until 11:30. And her plane left at noon. And that was the first time I ever saw Barbara look at her watch. And she looked at her watch 3 or 4 times and came in the room and sat down. And I think she was not sure she was even going to get to that plane. And I didn't act as if I was in one bit hurry.
And you went right up until the deadline?
Until the deadline, until 11:30. On the way to the airport, they were working on the road. One I took, and a road grader had stopped traffic, and it looked as if we weren't going to get by. And you talk about somebody looking at their watch. You see, Barbara hadn't said a thing to me about when it would be convenient. I say they can really get you on the spot. And these youngsters.
Well, they can get you on the spot.
Yeah, yeah. You know, by putting things off to the last minute and seemingly having enough time to do it. Of course, things don't always just work out. They used to do it with the greatest of ease. I think she does, she plans a little more carefully now.
A little more.
Yeah, yeah. Her mother would say just a little more. I think in Barbara's mind, to be involved with unimportant things like, you know, packing too early or making your plans or that sort of thing, that, you know, that should just be done sort of on the periphery. 3 weeks later, got a notice that there was a package for Barbara Long. And Nick picked it up, or we picked it up,
and it was this box, this suit box. The tape was off of it, but some of the rope was still on it, and it was still hanging together. But I could see clothes on all sides, and you could see in all the cracks, split on the ends. Barbara had said that she wanted to make her own arrangements.
Now that's the end of this last of this departure of Barbara. That's the end of Faith Count, Barbara's departure. And this channel went over around 300. And this is a long time afterwards. This is Sunday night, the 4th of January, 1970. This is Saturday night, January 17th, 17th of January, 1970. This is Saturday night after supper. Jim and Suzanne, Faye, Mamu's in her room. And Cookie just taking the first load of hay to sail. And the wind's in the south. Mr. Eastman has written this piece about lawyers having a special place in the other world. And then I recall that he had had lawyer difficulty with his wife. Politics and religion. And this is Channel 1 over. Channel 1 over. Around 305. Saturday after supper, this January 17, 1970.
Running trouble. That's it. I've got it connected, but it's not connected very well because it works in with the not only the railroads, but something else I read from.
There's another view of the country music.
The railroads are part of the country music. And, when my father and I went into the Houston station, it was a huge building, and it looked like that. I mean, it had been built for size and for business. And we went in, and the passenger part where used to be, people would just be crowded in there, and you'd go in this railroad station, and they'd have people all over the place, and just filling the benches and wandering around. But this time, there's only one desk for tickets and for luggage, and a few benches, and there weren't any. No one was there, and they had one porter, one red cap, and usually railroad stations, you have a lot of them. So we went on out onto where the trains came in. There's about 10 tracks, and only one of them looked like it had been used. And we wandered around a little while, and looking back in the other windows, and one area that had used to be passengers' waiting area was completely filled with desks and just been made into a business area. But in Houston, the enormous city, I think it's one of the largest in the United States, they only have one train coming in and out. It's the Texas Chief. It comes from St. Louis down through Dallas and Fort Worth and on down to Houston. It comes in at 8 o'clock at night and waits there all night and then leaves at 8 the next morning. And that's the only train they have, where they used to have dozens each day. In fact, not very many freight trains come in. My father said it made him kind of sad because he could remember during the war and after, when everybody rode trains, that they were crowded and it was often hard to even find a seat on the train. And especially if you were with somebody, because then you couldn't find two together. And he said he's glad his dad wasn't alive anymore, because his father had worked with trains and that had been his whole business. And his father thought the future was in trains, or trains represented the growth in the future. And he's just glad his father wasn't alive to see what the trains were like now.
That's it. All right, now what about your reading?
Well, the first thing I ran into was a magazine article called The Passing of the Long Train. It's all here. And it was just mostly pictures. But it did have one statement that, statistics, that in the past 40 years, 75% of passenger travel is just gone. It's just not there anymore. And it had a lot of pictures of the Pullman cars that had some little boys climbing in and everything. And that kind of brought it back to my mind that seeing those pictures out, my grandmother's house, we used to sit in the summers when I was little, we'd play outside. And then they'd send the kids in, myself and my cousin. We'd get all bathed and get our pajamas on. And then they'd bring a quilt out in the front yard.
Oh.
And we'd all lie there at night and just talk and everything. And then about 10 o'clock, the train would come across the street. And you'd hear the whistle off a long way, you know, you'd hear it whistle. And then it whistled a couple more times as it got closer. And we'd all watch, you know, it was at night, so you'd see the lighted windows all, and then it'd be gone, and then we'd go in. But, so that's what the pictures brought to mind. And then it reminded me that now, at her house, that train doesn't come anymore. If they've cut it off, it just doesn't run. Well, and then the other thing I read was something by Marshall McLuhan. Said that the trains are part of the myth of America. This expansion, the idea of the frontier, that people could take the train to go further out to start a new life. And they're gone now, and if that's so, then that part of thinking is, you can see that it might be gone too, that people don't feel like there's something else further out. And that brought to mind an article I'd read on Mustangs. An old man said that, talking about their way of life in the West, a ranch, you know, and being independent and all, they tell us it's, he said, all the old traditions are being packed away. They tell us it's myth and folklore. And then he says, well, maybe it is, he said, but I like myth. Maybe we need folklore. And that just kind of brought to mind the railroads, that even if they are what they call a myth, it wasn't a myth then, I don't think, even though they call it a myth because of the bad parts of that period when everything was growing and moving. Went on to say that it's part of the idea of the agrarian democracy, the social values built on the Jeffersonian man, which is like in the William Jennings Bryan that I mentioned the first time I talked about country music, that this idea of Jefferson's idea was a man that's independent and does things on his own and is responsible, and it's a social order built on that each individual is worth something in himself. And he said that idea is turned into lawnmowers and suburban houses. And that's the part that's about as far as I've gone, but it's something to look at.
Well, I remember I grew up with that from Brian, that the trouble was too much money from all those big corporations back east.
Yeah.
There's no way of stopping it. And if there had been, we would have found it and looked for it. Oh, yes. And I remember we just had to sit and wait for it to come. But now, you see, you don't have to wait. It just comes right.
The thing I think about trains passing comes to mind is, as country music goes, my family sort of come up with it, I guess, because my father and his family were dirt farmers in Georgia until they came south to Florida. And the country music in the small Georgia town was part of life. And when he grew up, he was 15, he told me, they used to, when they'd go to the store after something, they'd, if there was a record by a certain guy, Jimmy Rogers, they'd be sure to get it. And my uncle now has a stack about that high of his 78 that he got back in 34. And this guy was a brakeman on a train.
They call him the singing brakeman.
And now they're publishing his songs again and new albums, just his whole collection. And in every one of his songs, even if he's singing about his love or something, he'll bring the train into it.
Yeah, going when I get bucked.
Because I guess his love of the railroads was part of it. But one of his songs, Jimmy the Kid, is the name of it, and he names 8 or 10 railroads that have gone, and I know on the album it says that explains that these are old names, that these trains have passed away now, that you may not recognize these names, that calls them MK and O and all sorts of series of initials for them. But it's odd the way he talks about the trains coming in. He has one song that refers to name of it's Hobo Bill's Last Ride. And
your dad does that self-consciously. He does it on purpose. He don't kid himself.
No. I'm sure he likes it. It's funny that he likes the music, but he'll put it on. My mother can't stand it. And people that come in that have never heard country music before won't appreciate it. But someone that comes in that's grown up that way, says, ah, yes, I remember hearing about him, or I remember hearing his music before.
Yeah.
And, like I say, all of his songs point to this same idea that Suzanne was talking about. They show that his love of the trains, maybe more of the way he brings it out is of a southerner, as a Texan, that worked all his life on the trains. And I guess you might say that even at that time they were slowing down some. I don't know about that. But it's odd that nowadays you, of course, wouldn't have anyone that would even have anything like this way of life, I don't guess. A different way than what this guy had. Many people have a love for this.
My grandmother and grandfather ran into that they used to ride trains all the time because they visit a lot. And they'd take the Pullman because they're old. Well, this last time they took the Pullman, they had to look up and down the train to find the porter to pull the bed down. And then they had to pay him extra. That wasn't even included in their Pullman fare, that the porter would just come up with the bed down. And they're kind of upset about it. So they don't ride too much anymore. Cause in fact, they don't go too much anywhere. But Polly rode all the time. Just going out to visit her folks in Virginia, that's where she's born. Came out to Texas, my grandfather, I guess it was kind of a shock to her system at first. She used to go back and ride the train. We'd gotten home and surprised everybody. But
now this was a little letter.
Yeah. Well, the letter I wrote was about Nell.
Yeah.
Because I was surprised that she had done something that seemed to me that I've been trying to learn how to do. And she did it completely unconsciously. It seems that I was kind of babbling about the ranch and the horses, you know, and kind of what we were doing a little bit. And I mentioned that we were talking about country music. And she said that a lot of people who listen to country music did it because it reminded them they associated their hard times with the hard times in the song. That is just, they had lived through this kind of thing, and the songs sang about it, and so that's why they liked it.
I see it.
Well, the flea market, it started out a couple of years ago. It's, somebody owns just this big sand hill, and it's just sand out there. And he had a little house with antiques, evidently. Well, gradually he started building these stalls. They're just, usually they have like four posts and then a little shed-like roof on top. And he kept building one after another. And people come out there and rent the stalls for the day. And they set up a table, or else they can rent a stall with a table. And they get out there, and they have, oh gosh, they had these view things that you used to hold up, and you'd have a, just put little cards in that had overlapping pictures. I don't know what they call them, but they used to have them in the libraries. And you look in one end, and it's supposed to bring the picture into focus. It's like a Viewmaster, but old. And they have, well, each person, a lot of it's just a repeat. They have glassware, and one thing that we were looking at were the little salt dishes that they used to have on the table, the little tiny dishes of cut glass or pressed glass. And most of them are just clear. Some are in colors, and they have glasses and vases, special kinds of glassware. What was the kind you saw? It's some kind where they used mixed. They didn't have the right kind of glass, so they mixed in colors. Yeah, acroagate. Well, as you move down the stall, most of the people are, I guess, late middle age, most of them. Every once in a while you see a young couple. They'll have their tables out there, and they're just a heap full of things. They have old paperback books, records, and a lot of times they have boots or guns and knives and just dozens and dozens of gold and silver watches. And, of course, now it's gotten bigger than it used to be, so they have professional hawkers. They had one out there. You call him a barker, like in the circus, because he's out there showing how it's a knife sharpener, but he's cutting glass and cutting paper and using a sharpening machete, and he'd cut the paper and all. His hands had Band-Aids all over them, so du jour, how safe it'd be. But he's keeping on a constant stream of this talk, you know, like you've never seen anything like this, and just as easy, all you got to look down is this sheet here, and I'll show you how to do it. And some of the people out there look like they come out every week, and they bargain with each other. It looks like they just, they trade their merchandise with somebody else's merchandise, and they all end up with the same amount to sell. There's one man, he came running up this woman who had a lot of glassware. That was most of what she had. He says, I have something that looks like it's early Chinese, some sort of vase that was Chinese. She said, well, I can't come right now, but I'll be over in a minute or two to look at it. Now, it went charging back over his stall. And when I went to look at it, it was just this little flat-like dish. It looked just as ordinary as you'd find in a dime store. And a lot of the stuff out there looks like that kind of stuff that you just get in the dime store. But some of it is old, and a lot of it's real pretty. But then they have a lot of junk, of course. They had one poster. It was Lyndon Johnson and Mrs. Johnson and somebody else dressed up like Bonnie and Clyde, like the gangsters. And they had this black frame around, just real thin frame, and a big glass, and they were charging $15 for it. And Jim and I knew you can get the poster for $1.50 in the mail. They charged $1.50 for it. We went further down, and the thing that tickled me, one lady had a violin out there, and she's charging $150 for it. But the thing was, it didn't have any strings. So you'd have no way in the world of ever knowing whether there's anything wrong with the violin or not, because you didn't have any strings on. And the next one we went over was some man was looking at something a woman had. She said, it was a salt dish. What were we looking at? See, I forget these things. But it was a little salt dish, and she had $2 marked on it. She said, man came by this morning and told me that was worth a lot more than $2, but I have to go all the way back to St. John, I think she said. She said, I just can't carry all this stuff back. And it's just a little dish about half an inch long. She couldn't carry that back, so she put it down at $2. And that kind of thing kind of tickles me, because I just met there wasn't any man that came by that morning to tell her it was worth more, you know. But that type of talk where they offer you a bargain. And a lot of times you can get the price down a little bit. And the funniest thing is the whole thing, I thought, Faye was collecting salt dishes. Well, the very first stall she went to, there's a little blue one. So she looked at it, and Nell looked at it, and Bew looked at it. And they walked on, and they came back and looked at it again. Faye wanted it, because I guess it's about $2. So they walked on, and she bought some other salt dishes, and Bew bought some for her. And after a while, we heard them talking about it. So we walked on down. We didn't know which stall it was at, and we stopped this stall and picked it up and looked at it. I said, Jim, this must be the one Faye was talking about. And the lady said, yeah, there was a little girl back here looking at it earlier. Well, we walked on, and sure enough, when we were getting ready to go, Faye came back, and so did Bew and Nell, to look at it again. And they walked off, and Faye wanted it real badly, but Bew decided that it didn't look like it was really pressed glass. And Nell overheard the woman say, if they come back one more time, I'll let them have it for $1. So, and that kind of thing, or they bargained. And they're willing to put the price down. A lot of it's just visiting and talking.
Uh-huh.
And that's what Bew does when he goes out. Of course, he buys things. He bought some glasses and a pitcher and some real pretty little glasses to go with it.
Well, that sure is beautiful.
Didn't see him bargain. But generally, I think what he does, he just goes out and talks to them, and they have a price on it, and he might offer a price a little lower, and then they just come to a compromise, because he thinks bargaining is just, that's what you go there for. That's what the people like. They like to talk, they like to bargain. And most of them don't really care too much if they make a profit or not. They're just out there because everybody else is. It's a nice way to see people.
Mm-hmm.
And the only ones that kind of ruin the atmosphere to me are the professionals who get out there. And some of it, their prices are pretty outrageous. Of course, most of them are, but them can't bargain with too much. But some of them are this type of person who'll come up to you and just practice drag you in by the collar and joke with everybody. And there's one man, the perfect salesman type, which is the type that I can't stand, so I just kind of avoided him, but he just kind of won't let you go. You just stand and you try to move off, and he says, no, wait a minute, you know, and starts in on a new tactic.
And I'll say that again.
Faye and Bew ended up with about 5 salt dishes. They're $75 or $1 a piece. She's collecting them. And Bew came home with 2 real tall glasses with coaches and stuff in black on horse and coaches. And he came home with a little round brandy glass, I guess, or it's just a little tiny glass. And he came home with a pitcher, which we used for eggnog, and the glasses to match. And each glass, there were 3 colors and 6 glasses, and each glass had a color in the bottom of it, and made the inside of the glass color. And that's what came home with.
Okay, my grandmother and the owl. This is just a story she told. She used to always tell us. And it seemed like every time one of us would hear it and we'd go back, she'd tell us again, we'd all enjoy it again. And this was maybe 15 years ago, maybe a little more. They lived out in the country, in Dade City. They had a chicken coop in the back of the yard, and they had a lot of biddies out in the back. And my uncle at this time was, I guess, 8 or 10. And this particular night, they were both at home, and my grandfather was gone. And got dark, and directly she heard an owl out in the backyard. And they'd been missing a few biddies, and she figured she was going to get him this time. And so she ran out back, and she got my grandfather's shotgun, which she'd never shot before in her life, never even picked it up. And she got out back and looked around. Directly she spotted him up the top of the tree. And she's right back in front of my uncle's window where he's asleep. And she got back and she saw him. She said to herself she was going to get him this time because he'd been bothering him and got away. So she took the gun and she didn't know enough to put it on her shoulder. So she just sort of held it down close to her face with the butt of it up under her arm. And so she aimed at it and pulled both the triggers at the same time. And the thing came up and hit her in the nose, and the blood was flying all over her face. And she threw the gun up there. And my uncle heard the gunshot, and he come running out of the house and saw her with the blood all over and thought she had committed suicide. And he went running and screaming after my grandfather, and directly he drove up and saw it. And of course, he was always pretty calm. But that's just another one of her stories. And she can, when she tells it, she can make it so much to life that you feel like you're in the window at the house looking out, and you can see her with the shotgun pointed right at the owl up in the tree.
And they brought over this catalog that Barbara and Bob had sent him for Christmas, and it's a reprint of the Sears catalog for 1908. And they just had a time of that thing. We were looking in it, and all the old hats and dresses, and they had anything you could possibly want. They had food. They had veterinary supplies. There's things you don't ever see in the Sears catalog anymore. But we were looking at the shoes, and all these button shoes and tie and come up past your ankle, and the men's shoes, their boots, and they just had pages and pages of those. And they're all in the drawings. They weren't pictures, but they were drawings of these things. And then the price. And they had a medical compendium that could tell you everything you want to know about children's diseases and women's diseases and what to do and what kind of food to give them and what treatment. You wouldn't even need a doctor if you had that thing with you. But they really had fun with that. We were all looking in it. He's telling about the first time he saw a car. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
The kind of fences where he saw the car the first time were the rail fences where they just cut a corner of the rails and zigzag them and let the rail support sales. Well, he saw this car coming. Of course, he'd never seen anything except something drawn by a horse or a mule. Here he came banging and rattling, and he said he must have been going 15 miles an hour. He's just a little boy. So he backed up into the corner of one of those fences, you know, just as far as he could go to that thing was way on down the road.
I was just saying, we were just going out to give the horses some hay. Hell, it's 7:30. Sorry. Just indoctrinating them on, some of our jargon here. You know, the little points that we go by, we picked up in some of the, things that we've got. Like, one, reporting has more life in it than the experience itself. That doesn't sound plausible at all. But most experiences I've had, like that flea market thing, I'd have been right nervous and ready to go home after the first 15 minutes. But after we get home, and someone that really has a feel for it can report, you see, it really comes to life. Reporting does something you see that the experience doesn't do. This thing in Walden, I just call this Suzanne's attention. This is in the early section they call the reading. He says the Thoreau doesn't think too well of eloquence, of the spoken word. It's the written word No wonder that Alexander carried the Iliad with him on his expeditions. A written word is the choicest of relics. It is something at once more intimate with us and more universal than any other work of art. It's a work of art nearest to life itself. You see, that's the words bring it to life, sometimes clearer than the experience itself.
I was just saying that in the songs that we've picked up lately, a lot of the contemporary music we haven't enjoyed as much as these last few records we've gotten on Simon and Garfunkel. And these two can, their music is not easy to understand, and the words they use, and you can't understand it the first time you hear it, maybe not the second, but when you do sit down and go through it, it seems something more than just a story and experience. Though you're there, and you feel like you're in his place, and he makes it seem lifelike in the words he uses, it becomes more of a something almost you tend to worship, because every time you hear it, it kind of brings you to life as almost wanting to be in his place. Well, this is funny. He talks about, "Hello, lamppost, my old friend, I've come to talk with you again." These, where he talks about, says one place he turns his collar up to the wind, and his voice seems to change and the rhythm changes, where you can almost feel a coolness, feel like a dampness, like you picture a London fog, like with it just barely being able to see a glow on the lamp crossing a street corner, this sort of idea.
Now, this is 805 Channel 1 Over, 805 Channel 1 Over, and the end of this little tape with Jim and Suzanne at the middle of January, Saturday the 17th of January 1970. Saturday the 17th of January 1970, after supper, Suzanne and Jim, Harold, 810 Channel 1 Over.
And said, "Well, took me a whole quarter to learn, to get into the subject a little bit. Took me the whole second quarter to have a little idea of what I was supposed to know. And it took me a quarter of being away from him as last summer to let it hit me in the head as to what this is that he's talking about, the inquiry. And every time I listen, I learn more. And tonight, it seemed clearer than ever before." And I said, "Jim, you stick around, you'll learn." He said, he shook his head and he said, "It is interesting." He said, "Yes, I can see." And Suzanne just glowed. Because you see, this is the same thing that Faye wants, you know. If Ronald could just see once, then they'd have something they could talk about.
See? You want to face the
mic. And,
Look at me, but you talk into the mic.
Said that she got in the car. She said, I think maybe I'd better just not plan to work this summer. I mean, work on a job," she says. I said, "Suzanne'd be a great waste." Well, she says, "You know, there are those little financial considerations, but I'm going to think about it, because what I need to do is just to learn." And she told Jim out there in the hay that it sure spoiled you to have somebody like this, and then have somebody in the classroom who told you what to think. And I said, an inquiry was important in any field, and in mine, as the way that I had learned to teach, too. It helped my field. It didn't matter what you were in. And I like Jim, but he's, I can see. And he plays ball. He's very direct.
Suzanne's so tactful, so
yes.
Understanding.
Yes.
She'd never get in a corner. She'd never get me in a corner, or anybody, you know? She has that much understanding.
She seems to, yeah. Now she has, she cleaned up the trailer out there. She wanted Jim to see the possibilities of his bringing his books out, and he could study, and then he'd be on hand to have a little talk, and he could lend a hand. He carried that bale of hay. He just picked it up in one hand and carried it out in the middle of the pasture. It's like it was just like I'd pick up a pan over here. He's strong now. Be pleased, she said, they both could study. There was desks over there for both of them. And then they could get up, he could go shoot his bow and arrow, he could do something with you, or they could come over and report. That would be the main thing. And we were laughing about how we spent the day just around the reporting and how it had to be. And she really sees that this is the way, an exciting way. And you see, when she responded, that was pretty terrible at first. But when she settled down, she knew, and she was proud of herself.
And Jim picked it up.
And Jim picked it up. And they'll talk about this. And she says that she's always talked to Jim about you and your crisis. And he's heard her cuss. You can imagine how Suzanne cusses. I think this is a happy, a very special thing, and Suzanne seemingly just had rather be out here than anywhere. Oh, when we looked in the trailer there, and he put the potatoes back in for fear that it might rain or something. I said, Suzanne, you did clean up this place, and he said, why don't you clean up at the house? Suzanne says, I can't clean up the house because I'm always out here. But she said it in a light-hearted, you know, gay manner. And so...
You ever seen anything like Mr. Eastman?
He'd seen him.
Yeah.
I said that because he was dead when he saw him. They believed to be dead, so he knows he saw him.
So that was...